Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 4. Chapter is entitled Sati Kutsarbadi. And today's text 28. Tat Pashatam Ke Uvi Cha Abhutam Mahat Aha Iti Vada Sumahan Ajayata Hanta Driya Daivatamasha Devi Jaho Asun Kena Sati Prakopita. Tatpashyatam ke bhuvi chadbhutam mahad. Ahiti vada samahan ajayata. Hanta priya daiva tamasha devi. Jahavasun kena sati prakopita. Tatpashyatam ke bhuvi chadbhutam mahat. Aheti vada sumahan ajayata. Hanta priya daiva tamasha devi. Jahavasun kena sati prakopita. Please chant. Strategies. Antapriya daiva tamasha devi. Jahavasun kena sati prakopita. That's all right. Just leave it in. Tat, that, Vashatam, of those who had seen, Ke, in the sky, Uvi, on the earth, Cha, and, Abhutam, wonderful, Mahat, great, Aha, O, Iti, thus. Vada, roar. Sumahan, tumultuous. Ajayata, occurred. Anta, alas. Priya, the beloved. Daivatamasya, of the most respectable demigod, Lord Shiva. Devi, Sati, Jaho, quit. Asun, her life. Kena, by Daksha. Sati, Sati. Prakopita, angered. Translation and purport by Hestavangra C.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. When Sati annihilated her body in anger, there was a tumultuous roar all over the universe. Why had Sati, the wife of the most respectable demigod, Lord Shiva, quit her body in such a manner? Purport. There was a tumultuous roaring all over the universe in the societies of the demigods of different planets because Sati was the daughter of Daksha, the greatest of all kings, and the wife of Lord Shiva, the greatest of all demigods. Why did she become so angry that she gave up her body? Since she was the daughter of a great personality and wife of a great personality, she had nothing to desire. But still she gave up her body in dissatisfaction. Certainly, this was astonishing. One cannot attain complete satisfaction even if one is situated in the greatest material opulence. There was nothing Sati could not achieve, either from her relationship with her father or from her relationship with the greatest of the demigods. But still, for some reason, she was dissatisfied. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.6 explains that one has to achieve real satisfaction, the yatma suprasiddhi. But atma, the body, mind, and soul, all become completely satisfied only if one develops devotional service to the absolute truth. Savai pumsam paro dharmo yato bhaktir adhoksaja. Adhoksaja means the absolute truth. If one can develop his unflinching love for the transcendental Supreme Personality of Godhead, that can give complete satisfaction. Otherwise, there's no possibility of satisfaction in the material world or anywhere else. Tat pashatam ke bhuvi chadbhutam mahat Ahiti Lada Sumahan Ajayata Hanta Priya Daiva Tamasha Devi Jahavasun Kena Sati Prakopita. When Sati annihilated her body in anger, there was a tumultuous roar all over the universe. Why had Sati, the wife of the most respectable demigod, Lord Shiva, quit her body in such a manner? Om Gana Timarandasya Gana Timarashanakaya Chakshur Umritam Gina Tashmai Shiva. Before I became a devotee, one job that I had, I was a counselor for emotionally disturbed young adolescents. And a lot of them had made attempts at suicide. So, from the standpoint of the theory of psychologists and psychiatrists, people commit suicide, but actually, it's homicide 180 degrees around. They're usually very angry or very disappointed with someone. If they followed their instincts, they'd probably kill the person. So Sati was in a very disappointed condition because her father failed to reciprocate properly with her husband, Lord Shiva, and then failed to reciprocate with her. So their life is filled with perplexities, as we understand from the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. And it's just normal in human life. Prabhupada, in the purport to text 7 of the second chapter of Gita, describes that perplexities come just like a forest fire. And we don't even know who said it. No one said it, but the forest fire is there. So it's pretty much an all-pervasive element of life in the material world, that there's perplexity. So Arjuna was in a very perplexed situation. And of course we can understand that this perplexing situation was actually orchestrated by the Lord. So that the Bhagavad Gita could be spoken for the benefit of posterity, you and me and all of us. But very similar kind of circumstances. As a matter of fact, just before the battle was to begin at Kurukshetra, Arjuna requested Krishna to pull the chariot into the center of the battlefield so that he could survey, who he was about to fight. So it wasn't by chance that Krishna pulled the chariot up right in front of Dronacharya and Bhishma. And of course there was great affection that Arjuna had for both of these personalities. So it really kind of pushed the issue to the maximum limit. He already was in a difficult situation, faced with having to fight and kill friends, relatives, loved ones. So here's grandfather Bhishma, who raised him, and then Dronacharya, who is his respectable teacher, and right in front of him. So then Arjuna just like, wow, just way over his capacity to process the situation that he was in. So, karpanya dosho pahata subhava pichami tvam dharma samudha cheta yakshtreya nishtitam bruitan me shishasteham shadimam tvam prapanam. So Arjuna, he's doing the right thing. He's confused about his duty. He's lost all of his composure because of miserly weakness of heart. In the purport, Prabhupada expands this miserly weakness as originating from skin disease, from the bodily identification. And this is exactly what we're dealing with here. And then, you know, Arjuna, you know, he submits himself. I'm your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Now, please instruct me. Now, in this situation, you know, the perplexity came, and somehow or other, Sati went on with her business. You know, there wasn't some intervention. So it became very dramatic, you know, that she actually just was burned by the fire of, you know, this internal, this Agni within. In Ayurveda, you know, one's health is pretty much evaluated on the basis of the internal fire, the Agni, you know, how much you can digest food. So here's a fire that's so hot because of all of this frustration that she actually burns her body. You know, it's a, I guess we can say it's a yogic power or what have you. But so then Prabhupada, as he usually does, brings it right to the essence of the whole situation of everyone in the material world, that ultimately, regardless of the situation that one is in, materially, no matter how materially opulent one's situation may be, Arjuna, extremely opulent situation, in one sense, you know, being in such a, well, at least he had the opulence of high birth, you know, his kingdom, you know, was taken away, and, you know, he had the opulence of strength and also of fame and of erudition, you know, very learned in Shastra. And then Sati, you know, such an opulent situation, you know, the wife of the superintendent of the material world, right? One of the aspects of the personality of Godhead. And, you know, then the greatest king, Daksha, who may be in a bit of a fallen condition due to Vaishnava Aparad, but nevertheless, you know, this doesn't save one from dissatisfaction. You know, economic development, you know, there's this powerful illusion within the material world that if we somehow or other can increase sense gratification, then we'll be much more satisfied. But actually, the converse is generally what takes place. When I first moved to Mayapur, when I first started using computers, and there was a message probably on this Wincom free forum. It was a happiness survey conducted by some educational institution, and it was like over 100 countries were surveyed. And they were trying to establish an index of happiness or satisfaction in each one of these countries. And maybe some of you remember this survey. I brought it up in a couple Bhagavatam classes over the years. But does anyone know what one in the happiness survey, which country in the world was number one? You know, because you read the survey, you heard the survey? Janani Vas knows because I brought it up before. Yeah. Okay, you're disqualified. Okay, anybody know? Yogini Mataji, you know? Which country was number one in the, huh? What'd she say? That's right. You heard it before too, I think. Okay, so way down on the list was the crown jewel in every materialist's eye, the United States. India was number three, believe it or not. Now it's probably, if they did the survey over again, it'd probably be down to about 15, you know, because of the incredible economic development that's been going on here. So, money can't buy you love, right? That's what the Beatles would sing. And so what does bring happiness? So Prabhupada, very profoundly makes the point at the end of the purport, Nishyatma Supersiddhiti. Now this is from the second chapter of the first canto, and this is Sutta Goswami's response to the first question of Shonaka Rishi. Any of you Bhakti Vaibhava students recall what that first question is? Uh-oh. Okay, I mean, it's been a long haul from the first, the startup of the first canto, I know. Maybe you're dealing with information overload. So the first question that Shonaka Rishi asked on behalf of the sages of Namisharanya, of Sutta Goswami, is what have you ascertained to be the absolute and ultimate good for people in general, right? So now Sutta Goswami, he gets around to answering this first question. And Savai Pumsam Paro Dharmo Ito Bhaktir Hoksaje Haitaki Apritiyata Yatma Supersiddhiti. So the supreme occupation, the ultimate benefit, the absolute and ultimate benefit, the supreme dharma, param dharma, param dharma, is what? The supreme occupation for all humanity is to engage in the unalloyed devotional service of Adhoksaja, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such service must be haitaki apritiyata, must be unmotivated and uninterrupted in order to completely satisfy the self. So this is what, believe it or not, and depending on our level of faith, we believe it or not, this is what genuinely satisfies the living entity. Regardless of his situation, and a situation may be extremely difficult, which it was for Sati and was for Arjuna. Braj Mohan Prabhu, can you imagine what it would be like if you were asked to kill your grandfather, to kill your brothers, to kill your teachers? I mean, it would be heavy, right? Can you imagine the level of perplexity? So, you know, Sati's, you know, maybe, you know, I mean, she's really perplexed. So, but how to deal with that perplexity? This is the business of a Brahmin. You know, a Brahmin, he solves life's perplexities. You know, he uses his intelligence. He gets that intelligence from Shastra, from Krishna. So this Savai Pumsam Paro Dharma, you know, this supreme dharma, the supreme occupation, is what gives satisfaction. So now, we've all been devotees, for some of us for many years, and some of us newly beginning. So what I'd like to do is analyze with you today where this satisfaction actually comes from. What's its source? I mean, from time to time, we may be in an ecstatic kirtan, and we feel some ecstasy. Maybe it's a sneak preview of higher levels of Krishna consciousness. Rati Abbas, you know, sometimes devotees would experience this in Prabhupada's presence. They just experience incredible ecstasy. There's one story that Keshava Bharati Maharaj once told. A nectar devotion class in Vrindavan, he had he was working with the Radhadaman, he was serving with the Radhadaman or Bus Party at the time. And they all went to San Francisco for the San Francisco Rat Yatra in 1974. And devotees all went to the airport. It was like over 600 devotees. The movement was still a little small then. And they were all in the airport. There was an ecstatic kirtan going on. And, just powerful. They were on the concourse. This was, pre 9/11 days. So anybody could go on into the airport. There weren't security checks, things like that. And so, the kirtan became more and more ecstatic because there were passengers starting to come out from the finger, into the concourse. And then all of a sudden, Prabhupada put his cane over the little partition wall, that separated the concourse from the rest of the, from the finger, when they're going out into the airplane. And then the kirtan just became unbelievable. Just like people, devotees were just jumping in ecstasy. And then Prabhupada came out and everyone could see him. And then everyone, did full dandavats. Now, you know how it is on like Gaur Panim here in Mayapur. If you try to, during the Jai Om prayers, it's just like when Lord Brahma came into the presence of Krishna. All of the Lord Brahmas, there wasn't enough space for all of the Lord Brahma's heads. Some of them had a lot of heads. But, so it's like that in Gaur Panim here. Everyone can't get down, to offer dandavats. So Keshava Bharti Maharaj found himself in that situation. And what was the most amazing thing was that he saw that there were all of these businessmen with their briefcases that got caught up in Rati Abbas. And they were also offering their obeisances, full dandavats. Talk about amazing, miraculous development. Now, who knows what happened to those souls later on, but at least they got completely overwhelmed by Srila Prabhupada's ecstasy. So, how is it that we experience this ecstasy? This is a question that always kind of confused me, because I couldn't really find, we know that if, ayatma supersiddhiti, but where does it come from? Now I remember the first, when I was a new devotee, I'd been a devotee maybe about 2 months, and it was the first Janmashtami celebration. I wasn't initiated. This was in the 55th Street Temple in New York. And there was one devotee that was leading a kirtan, and he was very famous kirtan leader. He was leading a lot of the kirtans in the big pando programs in India. I'm trying to think of his name now. It's escaping me. I'm having a senior moment here. Huh? Who? No? No, he's Black Body. Dinanath Prabhu. And he was leading the kirtan. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't Dinanath. It was Jai Sachi Nandana. But he led kirtan in a very similar way. He was a Sanskrit scholar, and I won't say anymore, but he was a Sanskrit scholar. He did the first, the songbook, right, that we all, the Vaishnava Acharya songbook. And so what he would do was he would jump up and down, and it was like, and he would beat on both ends of the drum, and he would jump as high as he could. And I had just gotten out of I think I was still in the Bhakta program. And the training that we received in the Bhakta program, this was to kind of harness this American passion, was that we were trained to dance by jumping as high as we possibly could. So Jai Satsi Nandana was jumping as high as he could. All the bhaktas and everybody else seemed to be jumping as high as they could. And all of a sudden, this incredible experience started happening with me. They started dancing, and everything, the jumping, all turned into slow motion. it was like an ecstatic, you know, I think the first ecstatic, I mean, pretty remarkable one too. Everything turned in slow motion. And their bodies became translucent, and I could see the soul. And I said, what is going on? I was thinking to myself, you know, has the CIA, like, put some kind of, like, bliss guns, you know, and aiming at devotees? You know, there was a lot of paranoia about the CIA amongst the hippies in those days. I had no idea where this came from. So where does it come from? I mean, all of you are here, and you probably experienced at least some level of bliss, and you wouldn't still be here unless it were still going on. But where does that come from? So I did it, you know, and I would ask different devotees over the years. And then when I was studying to teach Nectar of Instruction in Juhu, what's the expression? Voila! You know, I found the answer. There was, you know, I had transcriptions of Giriraj Swami's Nectar of Devotion lectures. And they were a very difficult section of the Nectar of Instruction. Did I say Nectar of Devotion? I meant Nectar of Instruction. Where there is a description of the hierarchy of spiritual places and the hierarchy of spiritual personalities. And so how is it that Vrindavan is higher than Mathura, and higher than Vrindavan is Govardhan, and higher than Govardhan is Radhakund? And then of all of the spiritual personalities, the gopis are the highest. So it's all on the basis of the pleasure that Krishna derives from a relationship. This is actually the analysis. And there's some reference in the 33rd chapter of the 10th canto. So it's on the basis of the pleasure that Krishna receives by the service of a devotee, then the devotee receives reciprocation from the internal energy of the Lord, specifically Ladini Shakti, personified by Srimati Radharani, and the devotee experiences pleasure or ecstasy. This is the analysis that comes from the previous acharyas. So that's the whole idea. You know, when we analyze what pure Uttama Bhakti is all about, Rupa Goswami defines this as Anyabhilasita Sunyam, Jnana Karma Ninavitam, Anukulyena Krishnanu, Shilanam Bhakti Uttama. So when first class devotional service develops, one must be Anyabhilasita Sunyam, must be devoid of Anyabhilasita, of any material desires. It can't be covered by jnana or karma desires in this way. And anyabhilasita sunyam, jnana karma ninavitam, anukulyena krishnanu. Anukulyena, he needs to render favorable service. Now, one of the aspects of favorability is that, one, he does it with a positive mood, you know, unlike Kamsa, who was trying to kill him. And Krishna is actually pleased by the activities. I mean, Krishna is pleased by the activities of Kamsa. I mean, it's all arranged, you know, for his ecstatic pleasure. But Kamsa doesn't qualify for Uttama Bhakti because he's not doing it with that aspect of favorability. You know, he's not favorable. He, in his mind, he hates Krishna. So then, Shilanam means it's continuous. So it's favorable and it's continuous. So this is what, you know, this is what Krishna likes. He likes favorability. He wants to, you know, Anandamayo Vyasat. This is one of the characteristics of Krishna described in the Vedanta Sutra. He's always pleasure seeking. So if a devotee can give Krishna pleasure, then there's this powerful reciprocation. The devotee also experiences greater pleasure. And by experiencing greater pleasure, then the devotee is more able to renounce the material world and go deeper into Uttama Bhakti and give Krishna even more pleasure. And then he experiences more pleasure because Krishna is experiencing more pleasure, and you know, this upward spiral of ecstasy to the platform of prema. So there's a transition that we're going through from a grossly conditioned consciousness, fully convinced that I'm my body, to the platform of full conviction that I'm Krishna's eternal servant and acting on that platform. In the 11th canto, there's a very appropriate description of this bodily condition. Bhayam duti yabi niveshatashad ishari petasha vipariyosmiti tanmaya yato buddha abhijetan bhaktyaika yesham guru deva tatma. So fear overcomes the living entity when he identifies himself as being the body. So that the living entity, with this bodily consciousness, he turns away from the Lord. Ishadi petasha. He turns away. Ishad is Isha, Krishna, the Supreme Lord. And then viparyayoshmiti, there's a role reversal. Prabhupada sometimes translates viparyayoshmiti, ashmiti, forgetfulness. Viparyayo, misidentification. So there's a role reversal. Rather than seeing oneself as Krishna's servant, one conceives of himself as Krishna's competitor. Okay, this is the essence of material consciousness. I am the center of the universe. You know, who is this little blue boy playing on his flute, cavorting with all these beautiful young girls? Why can't that be me? And so then this whole consciousness, this wanting to enjoy separately, as if I am the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this is material consciousness. And so this whole facility is provided by the material energy to play out this phantasmagoria. Everyone gets their little Goloka Vrindavan with their little Radharani, and you know, they can play act as being the Supreme Lord. So the process of devotional service gradually dissipates this illusion, and we get more and more taste in our relationship with Krishna, and can more readily give up, you know, the bodily consciousness. So there's a subsequent verse in this second chapter, 11th canto, that brings us into a very clear picture of how this process works. Bhakti. Okay, so now this class ends at 8:45. It ends at 9? No. I think they changed it. So it's supposed to start at 7:45, but it doesn't anymore. It's not like the most natural time to start the class. So but it's supposed to end at 8:45, I believe, right? That's when. So why is everyone leaving now? I guess they're just getting ready, getting their digestive juices ready for prasadam. So there's a verse that describes how this takes place, and it has a lot to do with eating. So I think it's quite relevant because we're about ready to honor Krishna prasadam. Bhakti Puresh Anubhavo Viraktir Anitra Chaisha Chika Ekakala Prapadyaman Nasya Yatashnata Ashus Tushti Pushti Shudapayo Nugasan. So, bhakti, or devotion, direct experience of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and detachment from everything else. These occur simultaneously for one who's surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as one who's engaged in the process of eating, he first gets satisfaction, then he gets nourishment, and then he gets eradication of hunger. Okay, so now, Jiva Goswami, in his commentary on a famous verse, which I don't know, but it's from the second canto, fourth chapter, which describes one whose heart, when one chants Hare Krishna, or no, one whose heart doesn't change, tears don't flow from the eyes, hair doesn't stand erect, when one chants the Maha Mantra, is considered to have a steel-framed heart. And this is because of making offenses. So then, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he comments on this verse that, he quotes this verse I just quoted, Bhakti Pureshano Bhavo Viraktir, that a neophyte and a Kanishtha Adhikari can actually imitate, you know, can cry, and so that may not be a reliable method of ascertaining an advanced personality. But what is that he's detached from material enjoyment. Okay, so then Jiva Goswami analyzes this verse, first of all, bhakti, and the process of eating, or, you know, that there's tushti, there's satisfaction. So both of them, from bhakti, from devotion, and also from the satisfaction of eating, one derives pleasure, so they can be compared to each other. So then there's nourishment when we eat, and then that's compared to Paresh Anubhava. We gain direct experience of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that sustains us in our lives as devotees. When we can perceive Krishna's presence in our lives, it sustains us, it keeps us going. Say, wow, this is true. Everything that Prabhupada told us, you know, here's Krishna. You know, he's like coming to me and he's performing these little miracles in my life. So we get experience of Krishna's, direct perception of Krishna's presence. And then, viraktir, or shudapayo, viraktir anyacha. We become detached from everything else, and shudapayo, our hunger is eradicated by the eating process. So, with bhakti, you know, and also when we're full, then we can get some shanti. You know, when we actually are detached, then there's a peacefulness that comes within a devotee's heart. So ultimately, okay, I'm getting close to the deadline here. So ultimately, you know, if we're not getting a taste, this is due to offenses, all right, to the holy name. So what to do about that, you know? So the main thing that we can do is somehow or other chant attentively. This is the main facility, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Harinam Chintamani, if we can somehow or other overcome pramada, you know, this inattentiveness. So come hell or high water, if we can just hear the holy name, because that's the root cause of all the other offenses to the holy name, this inattention. Okay, so I'll stop here, and I'll read the translation again, and maybe there's some questions or comments that you have. When Sati annihilated her body in anger, there was a tumultuous roar all over the universe. Why had Sati, the wife of the most respectable demigod, would she have quit her body in such a manner? Now we have a message or a question from Chaturdevi from Cyberland, Cyberloka. Hare Krishna, my questions, he has two questions. As like Sati and Daksha, if we confront problem of parents blaspheming devotees, how should we react to it? As they are parents, we cannot disrespect them. At the same time, cannot tolerate the blasphemy of devotees. So how should this be dealt with? That's a good question. All I could think of is you could send them an email and explain. I mean, here we are in the cyber age. You could send them an email and explain to them that I can't really associate with you on the basis of the faith that I have developed if you do that, if you misbehave in this way. You know, explain the whole process of avoiding the association of blasphemers. You know, I love you dearly and I wish you well, but I can't come home and I can't be in your sangha if you're going to act like this. Now that may be a little disrespectful, or you get someone else, you use the indirect approach, you know, get someone else to explain to him, you know, the suffering that's being created for their child by this behavior. Anyway, you know, what to do, you know, it's, and then ultimately if one can't, if the parent can't control themselves, then you just have to avoid them. I mean, as difficult as that may be for in an Indian family, still in all, you know, that's a pretty important consideration. There may be some other ideas that the devotees have here. That's a very good question. Chaturdevi, I hope you're not in that situation. But I know that it happens, you know, and I've had friends that were in that situation, very difficult. Okay, that's the best I can do right now. And then in Bhagavatam 4.4.24 purport, Lord Shiva is referred to as Yogasvara. But in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna is referred as such by Sanjaya and Arjuna. So how does this coincide? Well, they both have mystic powers. And, you know, sometimes Lord Shiva is also referred to as Bhagavan, right? Full of all opulence. I don't know, you know, I mean, that's not usually in Bhagavatam classes, Jayadvaita Swami wouldn't entertain the question because it was outside of the range of the class. So, but, you know, I know that great personalities sometimes are referred to by the same nomenclature. So I'll just let that rest with that. I wouldn't worry about it. You know, it's you know, Lord Shiva is sometimes referred to as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I think he's referred to like that in a couple previous purports or some in the future. I was looking through and preparing for the class. I noticed that point. But, you know, we know Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So sometimes, you know, there's these idiosyncratic shastric descriptions that don't necessarily fit within logic and reason. But that's normal. Jiva Goswami, in the first chapter of 10th Canto, Prabhupada, or maybe it's like the second or third chapter. Prabhupada cites Jiva Goswami as saying, unless one can accommodate a chincha in the Supreme, one can't really enter into a relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's usually going to be some achincha factors whenever we study Shastra. So we try our best to understand, but ultimately, you know, if it's not within logic and reason, we just, okay, Hare Krishna, at some point in my devotional career, maybe I'll understand this. But don't be overly concerned with it, because that's by nature what transcendental knowledge is. It's a chincha. So it's received through the avaroha punta process, the descending process. You can't really grasp it with mundane intelligence. Okay, are there any other questions or comments from those that are here in that in cyberspace? Yes, Vasudev Prabhu.
Just refer to Lord Shiva as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or Lord Brahma also sometimes.
Yeah.
It means that, in a sense, also that Nityabada, we are eternally conditioned. So the word eternal can be flexible, it can refer to a very long period of time. So there are many use of words in the Vedas that are like that, they are flexible, they are context relevant, as opposed to context irrelevant. And this is my understanding anyway, and I think that...
English in particular is quite a limited language in terms of approaching transcendence. Yes, we have another question back here. Prabhuji?
This may be also a question that's not in the range of the class, but I was wondering, sometimes we do efforts to please Krishna. We might start a project, or for example a project, and the project doesn't turn out the way we want it, or it doesn't manifest. Would this be because Krishna doesn't want it to be, or because of He's just testing us, or because we have to go on with our perseverance? Like some devotees give the example of the League of Devotees, that Prabhupada also didn't succeed in one go.
Prabhupada didn't?
He didn't succeed in one go, that also the League of Devotees didn't.
Yeah, externally, there was over 40 years of very, very intense, that Prabhupada endeavored very intensely, and there was no perceivable positive result, you know, in terms of fulfilling in the order of a spiritual master to preach to the English-speaking world. I mean, he tried, but there was, you know, he still experienced great satisfaction internally just by going, trying his best. So that's the key, you know, to... It's not so much what takes place externally. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Karma divadi karaste ma phaleshu kadachana ma karma phalap hetu bor ma te sangos to karmani. So the results, you know, that's not what's relevant for the practicing devotee. I mean, Prabhupada would often say phalena parichayate, but there are results on many levels. There may be results on the perceivable platform, and then there's internal results, you know, on the platform of reciprocation between Krishna and his devotees. But the principle is to render service favorably without material desire, and do it continuously. And if we do that, but then we also have to know what's favorable. There's an example that comes to my mind. You know, Prabhupada very much emphasized book distribution. You know, there are many reasons that he did this, but ultimately this was the, you know, practically the essence of his mission was to write these books, publish them, get them into people's hands and get people reading them and studying them. Because he knew that if they do this, then the magic can start taking place. The transformation will start taking place. So we have to position ourselves in such a way that we can optimize through our, on the basis of our capacity, the pleasure that's derived by our activities, you know, that go to the parampara and to Krishna. We have to analyze, well, what's important? You know, what's going to give the most pleasure? It used to be that the pujaris, you know, in fired up sankirtan temples where a lot of books were going out, they would meditate on dressing the deities to enliven the sankirtan devotees, so they would do bigger on sankirtan. And when they would have that meditation, their service would be so much more ecstatic, because it was such a heartfelt desire of Srila Prabhupada. You know, because, you know, this came in parampara. You know, Rupa Goswami came to Srila Prabhupada in his quarters at Radha Damodar, in his, you know, spiritual form. I have, it's in a PowerPoint presentation that I've got. You know, Garga Muni has this, an oil painting of it hanging on his wall in Vrindavan. And Rupa Goswami came to Prabhupada. He was sitting there looking out the window at the samadhis, and then Rupa Goswami comes in to his quarters and says, "Maharaj, just go to the west and preach. Don't worry about anything, because I'll be right there with you." So it wasn't just, you know, Prabhupada would say that I was never without the sangha of my spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, because I was, you know, his instructions were always right there with me. But he also had Rupa Goswami. You know, we're all Rupa Nugras. Rupa Goswami gave us everything. You know, Prabhupada, you know, when Prabhupada took sannyas, he moved right into the Radha Damodar temple immediately the day after. Why? Because he knew that by doing that, he would access Rupa Goswami's mercy in a very powerful way. He dedicated, you know, what did Rupa Goswami do? You know, he focused, you know, on extracting the jewels from the Vedic literature to present it to the denizens of, you know, Kali Yuga Malecha world, you know, to deliver them, to bring them up to Krishna Prema. You know, he was empowered, as Lord Brahma was empowered from within the heart by Krishna to compile the Vedic literature. Similarly, Lord Chaitanya empowered Rupa Goswami from within. So Prabhupada very, very intelligently strategized and positioned himself in such a way that he could optimize the pleasure that accrued to his Guru Maharaj, the Parampara, and Krishna. We should do the same thing. Our business is not to please our own senses, as Pankajangri was saying yesterday. Our business is to satisfy the senses of Krishna. So we have to understand what will satisfy them. This is a big part of Anukulyena, Krishna Nu, to render the service favorably. Understand Krishna's mind. We have to understand Prabhupada's mind, their heart. What do they want? And so then we groom ourselves in such a way that we can most readily fulfill their desires and satisfy them. And then, poof, and all mercy comes our way. So, failure is the pillar of success. There's another key point. You know, if you don't succeed, it's a huge opportunity for succeeding the next time. And you pick yourself up, you realize that you had anarthas that prevented you from being effective in that service or that project, and so you move ahead. Maybe you re-strategize, you know, how to get the empowerment to do something that maybe would be even more pleasing to Krishna. But don't get discouraged. That's the last thing you want to do. That's Maya. You know, become even more determined. There was a famous American football coach Sorry to bring in something so mundane, but it just came across my brain here. And he said that when he was Vince Packard, he was the coach of the Green Bay Packers. And he said, when the going get tough, the tough get going. So it's actually, when we're under difficult circumstances, it's actually a tremendous facility that Krishna is providing us to go deeper in our Krishna consciousness. So don't lose the opportunity. And how to do that? We have very deep philosophy. Tate nukampam shukshamikshamanam bunjani vatmakritam vipapam nidvag vapubiravidan namaste jiveta yo mukti pade sadayabha. This verse from the 10th canto, 14th chapter, 8th text, Prabhupada said should be the guiding principle for all devotees. And it describes how we should deal with difficult and distressful circumstances. We should tolerate them, first of all, understanding they're coming about as a result of my own nonsense, my own past misdeeds. And then one should go on rendering service with body, mind, and words, understanding and offering all obeisances under the Supreme Lord. We should tolerate them. And then one becomes sadayabhak, becomes eligible to enter into pure devotional service. This is the key point. Because there's going to be distresses, there's going to be setbacks, there's going to be challenges. 100%. And, in the purporting to this text, Takte no kampam sukshamikshamano, Hirinayananda Maharaj and Gopi Prandan, they cite the previous acharyas in very powerful points. There. They describe this as, to enter the sun planet, one has to be fire-like. So this is a rigorous purificatory process. And so a big part of the process is the suffering that we go through in this material world and how to handle this in a Krishna conscious way. Because if we fail to do that, we'll likely fall down. And I say that with conviction because I can tell you a story. In the Srila Prabhupada Centennial Observance in 1996, there were petals of observance of the centennial of a lotus flower. Okay, I don't know, maybe there were 8 petals or something like that. Probably 8. And one petal was to reunite Srila Prabhupada's family. Okay, because many devotees had left the movement. So it was to bring it back together again. And the International Centennial Committee published 2 magazines that were entitled Unity Magazine. And in one magazine, there was an interview of the ISKCON musician, an American, Vyasaki. Now, Vyasaki and his wife had toured all over the world and had visited over 700 devotees that had stopped practicing Krishna consciousness and stopped affiliating with ISKCON. Now, right in the very beginning of the interview, he said there were 2 common denominators. One of them being that these devotees still had deep love and respect for Srila Prabhupada. 2, the second common denominator was that somehow or other they were unable to accommodate the aspect of our philosophy presented, and then he quoted the verse, Tate nukampam shukshamikshamana. So you're going to suffer, you're going to have challenges, you're going to have reversals. That's how you handle it that counts. If you handle it properly, you make more advancement. If you, start playing the blame game and blaming everybody else for your suffering, or start feeling, oh, woe is me, and then you become the center of the universe just by your depression, and then, you'll become degraded by this, by your mind. If you follow the formulas that are given by the previous acharyas, and one really intimate understanding that's given by the acharyas in their commentaries on this shloka is that just as a son has complete faith that his father is always acting in his best interest, you know, sometimes the father will come in and give him a big embrace and pop a laddu in his mouth, and sometimes the boy will be running across the street and almost gets hit by a tata sumo, and then a father whacks him heavy. But the son knows that his father loves him and is acting in his best interest. So we should have that kind of faith, because we're, and also within this purporting, in the commentaries of the acharyas, it's very clear, this is not karmic reaction. This is direct intervention in the life of a devotee by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's arranging, just as Krishna arranged for Arjuna. He took him right up in front of Bhishma Dev and Dronacharya. So Krishna is also making these arrangements in our lives. Why? So we'll become fed up with this material world. We'll become disgusted with it. And we'll take deep shelter in him. He's just helping us to shatter the illusion that this world is a place where we can be happy without Krishna. And I'll tell you one last story and then we'll end. Okay, I had just learned this shloka. It was in 1984, 85. I'd learned it in the last year. And I went to Vrindavan during the Gaur Purnim festival period. And this was pre-bottled water days. It was before you could go and, you know, buy bottled water at all the tea stalls and, you know, the... So there were designated locations. Like here, there was Prabhupada's well over here on the side of Lotus. And then there was safe water in the Gurukul in Vrindavan. Padmalochan actually told me this water is okay to drink. Anyway, there was a very high incidence of dysentery amongst devotees in those days compared with what happens now during the festival, because now with the advent of bottled water. So I got really sick. I mean, super sick. And the devotee, one good friend of mine, Hamsarupa, he was in charge of the samadhi construction in Vrindavan, and he also happened to have been the assistant bhakta leader when I was in the bhakta training program in New York. And he just said, well, just handle it naturally. So he gave me isabel, which is an Ayurvedic thing, a little medicine, you mix it with dahi. And then I just had isabel and dahi and green bananas. And this went on for 3 weeks. And Prabhu, I was so sick. And it wasn't that I was, you know, I couldn't do anything. I had like 40-50% of my waking hours was spent on the toilet. You know, I mean, forgive me, but I mean, it was like, then I would get these excruciating cramps that must have been a reasonable facsimile of the pain of childbirth. I mean, it was heavy. And what I did, you know, because I just had learned this verse and I was trying to make some sense out of this, I recited, you know, and when I'd go to, you know, the older devotees, Keshava, he was Karandar's brother. He was the first big book distributor in our movement. He discovered how to distribute big books in San Francisco. And he just happened to be in Vrindavan at the time, and he said, yo, Jamasimu, we used to call it the knot. You know, when you'd get this excruciating like pain from the cramps from dysentery. And so what would happen, you know, I couldn't even, I would just be grimacing in the toilet, you know, But I recite this sloka in my mind. I didn't even say it out loud because I was too busy grimacing. And I recited it in my mind, and my God, as soon as I would do it, then I'd be in ecstasy in the most disgusting you know, painful circumstance. I just recited, I didn't even understand it completely because it was new, but just reciting it, you know, put me in ecstasy. So we have a lot of tools philosophically to deal with the perplexities of life, but ultimately what we have to do, just as Arjuna did, we have to take shelter of the process, take shelter of our guru. Huh? The shloka? Karpanya dosho, that one? Oh, which shloka are you talking about? Tate no kampam shukshamikshamano? That's the one, yeah. That's the shloka, you know, how to deal with suffering. And then I would, you know, in my mind also recite the translation. Poof. You know, and that shloka became my best friend. After that was the introduction to our long-term relationship. So many crises have come and gone, you know, and that, you know, that friend has been right there with me to hold my hand, you know, in the dark night of the soul. Experiences. Okay? All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.